This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. My guest today is Karina Mills, Senior Talent Director and Senior Associate at RDC, the multidisciplinary group behind RDC, Dylot Interiors, and Studio 111. As an architect, Karina is also serving as the 2025 President of AIA California. With a background in technical architecture from Cal Poly Pomona, she's grown into a leadership role focused on improving practice and advancing inclusivity across the profession. Karina brings both her heart and her vision to work, and I'm excited to dive into her journey and insights today. So Karina Mills, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's awesome to be here. I appreciate the time.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. Let's dive right into your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what might have inspired you to get started?
Sure. I love telling this story. I actually have the benefit of being with all new staff and onboarding, and so I get to tell my origin story quite a bit.
Great.
And I think it's really valuable too in AI forums to be able to hear, you know, where people started and how they've come along. So like many of us in architecture, I fell in love with it as a kid. I was torn between law school and architecture school, and I was not an avid reader. I had part of the influence of going into architecture school, but also I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, and the U of O has a really wonderful architecture program. And I had already expressed my interest in the profession as a high school student. And we actually had the pleasure of working with a topic studio from the U of O to imagine what a new addition to our high school would look like. And so that really sealed the deal. I was looking at programs outside of Eugene since I was born and raised there. And my high school was just down the street from the U of O. And we had a neighbor across the street who was an architect married to an engineer. And my dad went across the street and asked them, you know, where would you hire students from? And they mentioned Cal Poly a number of times. And so that had a lot to do with influencing that, and that I was a math and science student more than a art student. And so I was really looking for a technical program. and learned that I had a lot of passion and creativity in the more design side of practice. But then once I graduated from Cal Poly Pomona, I was really looking for a technical field. I started at a small firm in Orange County and did a really long drive across LA to get my foot in the door and did retail rollouts mostly for the first couple of years as an intern and my first year full time. There was a lot of discussion in school about, do you want to work for a big firm or a small firm? And a lot of folks who talked about how you get lost in a big firm and that small firm practice culture was a better way to be seen, a better way to learn how to do all the things. And so I leaned on that advice and went to what to me seems small when you hear my whole story. It was a 40-person practice. I worked there for a year and I was really disillusioned. It felt like we were sort of cranking out projects. There wasn't a lot of design and creativity. There wasn't a lot of opportunity to learn about innovating in the technical space. I was really good at getting a permit. I was really good at exiting plans. I was really good at, understanding what different jurisdictions were looking for from the plan review process. And after doing that for a year, I was like, okay, I'm ready to move on. I'm an eager learner. I want to do something challenging. In my last year at Cal Poly, I had the benefit of working with a healthcare design practice. It was a conference that one of my professors invited me to. And so that experience and some outreach to my colleagues from Cal Poly led me to HDR, which is a huge firm, obviously. And I spent almost 7 years there. I got licensed there. I worked in a large firm on small projects, which was a really unique and wonderful opportunity because I still got to have that role of, working on projects from start to finish. But I was in an environment with really a lot of resources where we had like a regional director of quality management and somebody who had like all the books and tons of experience. So I really accredit a lot of my rapid growth in the profession to being in that very unique experience and, working with a small project team sitting on the floor with engineers and being able to go straight to engineers and say, tell me how to explain this to the client because we only have budget for me to go. All of those things really helped inform my ability as a project architect and as a manager. So once I got licensed, as many people in the profession do, in order to get the salary and the title that I was looking for the experience that I had gained, I moved on. And I went to a 40-person practice that did healthcare only, and I was there for about 4 years. It was a really great place to spread my wings and learn that I didn't have a regional quality control manager to go ask all the questions to. I was suddenly the person being sought out for advice and guidance. And it was a really dramatic flip to realize that you felt like a junior person on the team to being the person that was sought out for guidance and expertise. And I grew in leadership there. I joined the AIA when I joined that firm that brought me to Long Beach. And then once I was in AIA, which I really sought out because even though I've lived all over the LA area in my journey since starting college, I didn't know anyone in Long Beach specifically. And I was terrified of this part of our profession where you go to a conference or a networking event and you don't know anyone and you have to like hand out your business cards. It was just absolutely terrifying to me. And so I thought I better learn how to do it. And so I joined AI really for that reason in the beginning. And then I was immediately asked to join the board. I dove in face first, became a director, was president-elect in a couple of years, and was navigating my leadership role with this 40-person healthcare firm at that time. And really started to deepen my knowledge about leadership and the challenges that it holds. I left that firm and went to another large A&E firm and was there for a year. It was the shortest firm stint that I had. I was taking the train from Long Beach to downtown LA. It was a really different culture, practice that won a lot of their work through competition. And I found that the culture of the office was also very competitive and it was just not a good fit for me. And so at this point, I started reaching out to my AI colleagues saying, I might be unemployable. Like I'm in this leadership space and I'm being called a troublemaker, even though I'm really trying to like do my best and advocate on behalf of the junior staff on my team who are saying, I need more money and I need to be seen and I need to be encouraged. So all of that culminated into being invited to interview for this role with RBC as the Senior Director of Talent Management, which had envisioned somebody who had worked at least 10 years in the profession, who had gone through architecture school, who had walked a mile in the shoes of the people that they would be advising, but who really had a strong passion and interest in the operations of the business and growing and developing talent. I like to tell in my story that when I got the job description, it was a half a page of bulleted job description and about 10 pages of articles that were talking about this emerging trend. So it was a new role. It was absolutely terrifying to be 100% overhead after over 10 years of, you know, being a very billable architect. But it was too exciting to say no to. And it's been almost 6 years since I signed that offer letter. And it's been a really wonderful journey. So since then, I've moved on to AI California and the executive committee. I've served with the executive committee. This is my 5th year. And now as president. And so those two roles, AI leadership and my journey as a leader in talent management, have really helped inform each other. So whenever I get inquiry from the practice about, you know, how is this an investment in them, I just remind them that it gives me so much perspective and so much insight to be able to talk with architects and practice leaders across the state to better inform the work that I'm doing here. And hopefully by testing it with RBC, I'm also able to give back to the profession at large. So that's the goal. That's the story. That's where I came from and where I am today.
Yeah, great story. And I want to dive deeper into your role at AIA and understand what you're doing there and what your goals are. Before we do that, I want to understand more of your role at RDC. It sounds very interesting. I've never heard that title before. I'm assuming it's a large firm.
Yes. According to the AI scale, we're a large firm. We're about 170 people altogether. As you mentioned in the intro, we're House of Brands firm, RDC being one of them. And so to me, having worked at HDR and other A&E firms doesn't feel like a huge place, but relative to the folks that I work with in the AI environment, sole practitioners, you know, we're a medium-sized firm is 20 people. I do understand that we're big in the team.
Yeah. So what's your role as talent director, you said?
Talent director. Yeah, talent director for short. I describe my role in the shortest nutshell as the bridge between operations and human resources. I have always had a strong passion for the human experience of doing the job. Another part of my story that I like to tell, when I interviewed at HDR as a junior professional, I was only a year or two at school. I got the question, what's your long-term goal? And the managing principal who was asking me the question later clarified that he was looking for me to say I wanted to get licensed. And I was like, oh, I see licensure as a medium-term goal. My answer was that I want to love my job forever and ever.
Good answer.
And so it evolved from wanting to protect that for myself and make sure that I didn't burn out, because in that first year I saw sort of a narrowing tunnel. And, you know, that really blossomed into wanting to offer that hope and goal for others in the field.
Your experience is pretty diverse in terms of size of firm and interaction with architects at all levels. What would you say are some of the things that you've learned in your experience in the profession that you're bringing to AIA California?
I think we have more in common than we have difference. And, you know, in so many ways in my own firm with the House of Brands and different typologies, there's, you know, the struggle that I experienced within our team of 170 people, from the largest team of 50 to the smallest team of 12. That, you know, there's a lot of inclination to say, well, the way that you're doing it doesn't really apply to me. I have to do it my own way. And obviously there are those unique differences, but there's so much to be gained and leveraged by looking more at what we have in common. And so I think too, when I lead these conversations, even, you know, earlier on in my AI journey, being an attendee in a large session talking about mentorship or practice culture, I couldn't tell you how many tables I sat at where people, mostly from small firms, said, this doesn't apply to me. You know, feeling like there was a different conversation going on that didn't relate to them. And I often have heard from people who work in an office of less than 10 that their experience as an emerging professional, somebody who's trying to gain licensure, somebody who's trying to grow, is very much the same story as the people that I worked with at HDR and people who are in firms from across scales. And so I think mostly what we're struggling with is self-awareness and an eagerness to grow and learn, irrespective of where we are in our tenure. And I try to model that behavior. I try to, you know, be honest about what I still have to learn and grow in, and encourage our fellow leaders across AIA and our practice to also be curious about what we could do better.
So what are some of your high-level goals at AIA California? What are you hoping to accomplish during your tenure?
So there's two big things. I recently wrote a piece called The Great Restructuring, and that is about moving our governance structure into a new model that is more nimble and adaptable. We're a very big board. And for as long as I've been on the AI California board, this is my 9th year, we have been big and have been talking about changing. So, you know, in this notion that I'm the bridge between operations and human resources, I am very attentive to the experience and the eagerness to be part of AIA to protect the legacy of who we've been and how we've worked, but also understanding that we can't be beholden to what we've always done or we won't survive. And, you know, now it's, we're going to do this, folks. So that's one thing. We had our big meeting, our in-person meeting last week. We're working through those, the fine-tuning of those changes. I'm looking to implement that and a vote at the end of this year. At the same time, I have been part of an initiative called the Culture Shift, which is about creating an awareness campaign at its most foundational level, but also specific action items and resources, narratives from people who are setting a good example about how we evolve as a practice and how do we respond to the culture shift that's happening socially, the demands that our emerging talent are asking of us as practice leaders, from everything to from compensation and the value propositions and making sure that we're feeling like we're doing meaningful work and that we're, you know, our strengths are seen. Coming from an academic environment that's about pinning up and criticizing, you know, and that's sort of like the Beaux-Arts tradition of learning. We've all gone through that experience, but there's a lot of folks now who are, you know, in our emerging talent pool who are looking for a different value proposition from the firm. And if we want to continue to increase our pipeline and be more diverse and give a fair chance to everybody who's, you know, dedicated their education time and passion to being part of this profession, we as practice leaders need to change.
What would you say are some of those major changes that have to be made culturally to recognize this incoming new way of doing things?
So one of the things that I hear the most and I say the most too is that we have to move beyond boasting about our overwork culture. That, you know, that I've sat again in so many AI forums where the experts, the leaders, the people that were eager to become at the front of the room start off saying, you know, well, I got here because I never worked a 40-hour week. Right. You know, there was lots of late nights and lots of hard stuff. And it is a difficult and demanding job. And I think a lot of us are passionate and want to work. You know, that's sort of the nature of the tribe. But I think to hold it up and celebrate it to the level that we have traditionally is a mistake. That now there is a lot of interest in understanding what is the balance. You know, again, the bridge to operations and human resources, being attentive to the human experience of, you know, wanting to make sure that there's rest time. So that really has to be embraced. And I just in last week's meetings in California, talking with many of our practice leaders there, there is an acknowledgement that that shift has been happening, that they know that they have to do that and they can't continue to expect or talk about these like 50, 60 ridiculous hours. So part of it is the amount of time. Part of it is the compensation proposition value, being more comfortable talking about money. And also, we had a Women in Architecture forum on Monday where we were talking about pay equity and, you know, negotiating your value and just understanding. One of the things that I think we don't do well enough is consider the whole compensation package for those of us who are employed in the business and making sure that in addition to base salary, are we talking about bonuses? Are we talking about the time off that we need, right, you know, the overall balance? And so all of those things, I think, are important to just mostly have the conversation that it's not like, if you want to stay in this business, if you want to have a job, if you want to have a lasting career in architecture, that, you know, the same goals and expectations that applied to me, who's been practicing for 40 years, says my boss, still apply to me. And it's like, that's not really a good deal anymore. We're seeing too many people leave the business.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to rcat.com/arcademy. That's ARCAT.com/ARCATEMY. That's ARCAT.com/Arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. The idea that architecture is hard and we work lots of hours, as you know, has been part of our culture as architects for hundreds of years. It's like, it's just the way it's always been. It's not the way it should be. When I analyze that, I see weakness in business and systems. And, you know, architects aren't taught business in architecture school, and they come out of architecture school without that knowledge and start businesses, because so many architects want to have their own firm, but they don't understand how to run a business. And so they just fall back on what they've been taught or what the culture has been, right? All-nighters in architecture schools, where it starts, right? And it just continues and perpetuates through the profession. But as we focus more, and we are as a profession focusing more on architecture firms as businesses, we will learn to have more time for those things that we need, because it'll be part of the business. It'll be part of the process of systems that we have. We'll also be making more money as businesses to be able to compensate the people who are working within our firms and not have to work 60 hours, 80 hours a week, because we'll be making enough money to have fewer projects and to compensate people properly without having to work 60 hours a week. And so I commend you for focusing on that at AIA California. So do you see the change happening as you talk about it, as you focus on it, or do you see resistance in the profession?
Both. I see both. And I'm aware that when I'm in forums with AIA, especially as a board of directors or an executive committee, it's a little bit of an echo chamber. You know, we're there because we want to see the community move. So I'm really excited about the outreach that the Culture Shift Initiative is having, because we're inviting more, you know, that like ripple effect. We each ask a friend and get beyond the boardroom in terms of participation and getting people to tear up the narrative. And that's the idea, you know, for anybody who is a small practitioner who says, you know, I'm restricted by the resources that I have, and this is a really great story. I want to do this, but it's just not possible for me at the scale that I operate. Or it could be, you know, I already do that because I am just three people and I'm super attentive to the staff that I have. What I think is so valuable, and just what you're doing here, is creating an opportunity for people to share their narrative and make sure that we're hearing how did they do it and what is the outcome that's happening by it. At the AI National Leadership Summit, which brings together president-elects and presidents from across AIA in Washington, D.C. every year, there was a couple of practice leaders on stage, including Ilya Azarov, our incoming president, talking about the innovations in their practice. And this year's president, Evelyn Lee, mentioned that they were there because they're the competition. They're offering four-day work weeks. They're offering flexibility. They're integrating technology into their ways of operation and looking at ways to change the way that they're doing business. So really beacons of, you know, the future of the practice, and helping us understand that if we don't, first of all, not aware that this is the competition, and if we don't try to level up, we're going to struggle to be competitive in the talent market. And, you know, I recently spoke with a practice who's still mostly in CAD and talking about wanting to get into Revit, not necessarily because it's what their small project typology needs, but they know that the staff that they want to hire need to be fluent and proficient in Revit. And if they're not offering that work experience, they're not competitive in the talent market. And so understanding that so much of what we do as a business, to your point, architects don't understand business.
Yeah.
We're selling talent. We're selling hours of our talent. And if you can't be competitive in terms of offering what that talent needs today and where they want to grow to, then your business is going to suffer. And I think, you know, the more that we can share stories, both about people who are adopting that and demonstrating how successful it can be to those who are skeptical, and then also having, you know, really compassionate conversations with people who are saying, like, I've been doing this for 30 years and I don't know how to do it differently.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, then let's offer you some resources and give you some partnership with somebody who's wanting to coach you along. And I think just trying to get everybody to understand that these conversations are not an attack. It's, you know, just an awareness campaign again, and trying to make sure that, you know, we as a profession can survive. And the only way we do that is to continue to be of interest to the people who need to work in the business and sell those hours.
Yeah, that's a very good point, that sometimes the resistance is coming from fear, that they've done it this way their entire career. It's worked for them to some level, and it's the way that they've been taught, and they don't know another way, and they don't know how to change. And so being compassionate toward that and recognizing that it's not just, this is the way it's going to always be. Sometimes it comes through that verbally, but maybe there's more behind the lion that's roaring.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's a scary thing to be that vulnerable. Last week, we were having a conversation at our in-person board meeting at the end of the day about AI, as many of us are, you know, and how it's going to change our practice, and trying to really be excited about the future that it can offer us. And someone at my table said it very honestly, like, I don't know how to imagine doing this job a different way. I've been in this business for 40 years. But I'm interested in what everyone here has to offer, and especially eager to listen to the more junior side of the profession who can help me be more open-minded to what that can look like, help me evolve.
For architects who are listening now and are in that position where they recognize that they need to make some changes in their firms in order to continue to grow and to continue to attract talent, what would you say are the big things that they need to look at in order to recognize and start to make those changes?
I think it's a lot of understanding that, I'll speak from my own personal narrative and also from so many that I've spoken to, a lot of us get into architecture with an eagerness to learn and grow. It's built into our practice as licensed architects that we have to do continuing education, that the technology in our buildings is constantly changing, that our materials are always evolving. And so for better or for worse, whether you sought it out or you're realizing that it's a condition of the profession, you have to learn and grow. And I think that what has happened in, you know, decades past, that the survival instinct of me as a creative learning how to do business led us to these departmental, let's do architecture like a production line, and you're going to do design, and you're going to do production, and you're going to be the nimble team of people who can execute it on a construction team. And it became a very unappealing value proposition for a lot of people who are design-minded. They want to get the whole picture, and they want to continue to learn and grow. And so when I joined RDC, there was a lot of that legacy in the firm. We had a couple of senior guys who did a lot of the construction management. And when they were getting ready to retire, I was asked, you know, who also leads hiring and recruiting, how are we going to replace them? And I said, we're not. We're going to let job captains be the front line of answering RFIs. We're going to really go and evolve our workflow, because that's what I've been hearing my entire career from my peers, that they really want. And if they can't have that, they're going to look elsewhere. Not in another firm, but in another profession, another way to use the design thinking and the training to do something that's really big picture. And so I think that we have an obligation to find ways to make our talent know that they're invested in, that there's an exchange in terms of, you know, you're coming to work for us, yes, for a salary, but also for career growth, you know, to make sure that we're being true to your passion and your interests, and that we're growing those strengths. And I think for the talent who feel invested in that way, they are giving back volumes in terms of, you know, what the business can do and grow in, and that we have a responsibility to continue to be curious about how our talent can grow and evolve.
As the profession does evolve, looking into the future, what do you think a typical small firm practice will look like if we succeed with this culture shift?
I think that so much of the story of small practice is going to that analogy of architecture as an assembly line. A lot of small practices can't do that. They don't have enough people to fill the respective seats. And so there's a lot of, you know, the multiple hats, everyone, all hands on deck. And I think that's such a wonderful story that I really want to applaud and encourage small practices to continue to do. I hear a lot from small practitioners about the challenge of growing, you know, from one person to three people, from three people to 10 people. It's so difficult to understand how to delegate and just change the workflow. And so I think the most successful stories have been the ones where that senior leader is looking for good people who fit with values, who understand, you know, the reason that they got into architecture and they love doing business, and that they find those personality matches and find the specific skills that those individuals bring, right? And so it's less of a, you know, me as a business leader, this is the square peg, you know, that I need to fill, and a little bit more of figuring out how do we grow and flex as a team, a little bit more of, you know, how do we work as a hive or a network, even in a small group. And so I think it's a challenge to evolve in that way when we're sort of, you know, we've been confined by our contracts and construction. Our contracts as AI has set them out for the last many decades, or the job descriptions that we drafted that say you're going to do these specific things. And I think the more flexible we can be, that the better off we are ultimately, and that's the better value proposition for the talent you're seeking.
As we wrap up here, before I ask my final question, I want to talk directly to the principals and the firm owners. What's your call to action to those people, the people who have the control to be able to make the decisions, to make those changes? What's your call to action to principals and firm owners?
So one of the things that I hear the most in forums is that mentorship is needed. And mentorship is used so often that I sometimes call it the M word, because I think that we're talking about something that we don't really fully understand. And I've leaned into coaching as a description more than mentorship. Mm-hmm. But from the time that I was in school to today, I think that there is this romantic notion of this apprenticeship model that doesn't really have a place in modern practice. Unless you're two people working in a firm, you're a sole practitioner with an assistant, assistant, somebody who's helping deliver your work, that outside of that, that traditional apprentice model is dead, and that you need to leverage the support of peer groups. As a practitioner, you need to seek out your peer group and understand what your competitors are doing. Like, have a friendly banter, not necessarily about who your clients are and what your fees are, but like, how are you doing your business and how are you growing your talent? How are we supporting and sustaining the practices in the profession as a large? And then also encourage your junior talent to also support each other, also lift each other up, you know, provide the feedback of like, this is what I see you doing really well. How can I learn from you? Or how can you do this even more? I really deeply believe in the value of peer support. And so I want to encourage everyone to lean into that more.
All right. I love that. That's what Entree Architect does every day. So you have a home here if you're looking for that.
Perfect.
All right. A final question. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
The best thing that I think that the small businesses can do is to make sure that the team members that are working for them feel invested in. And the way that you think that lands might not be how it's received. So make sure that you're having an open conversation with your employee, being curious about how am I doing as an employer? I think that I'm offering these things to you. Is that what you're experiencing? Because in so many years of being part of leadership and being especially focused on the emerging professional population, what I see over and over again from the small breakout tables to large-scale surveys is that what practice leaders think that they're offering is not what the junior staff feels that they're receiving. So make sure that you're creating a community and an experiences where you can have a candid conversation that's safe so that you can bridge that disconnect.
Very, very good advice. It goes back to culture, right? You have to have a
very much.
Build a culture that allows for that, to have that safe space to back and forth. It's not something that just happens. It's something that you have to be very intentional about.
You have to work at it and you have to invest in it. Yes, very much.
Yeah. Her name is Karina Mills. The firm is RDC. If you'd like to go see more about what they're doing, you can go to rdccollaborative.com. AIA California is where Karina is the leader, president this year. So you can check them out there as well. Karina, will you be in Boston?
I will. I look forward to seeing many of you there.
All right. Well, we're having a meetup at the Trillium Brewery. So I hope you have some time and can join us there.
I would love it.
On Thursday at 8 p.m. After all the AIA stuff is done, come out and hang with us at the Trillium Brewery.
Awesome.
Great to have you here. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for your leadership throughout the years and at AIA California. And thanks for sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
It's been my pleasure and thank you for having me.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, two a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember three words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.